Welcome to Rafa Said It Here, a show about everything and anything that happens in our lives that impacts our mind, body, and spirit. I am so glad that you're joining us today. Welcome to the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Rafa Said It Here. My name is Rafaela Silva, and I'm so glad that you are joining me today. We have an exciting show. I'm so excited, you guys. I have a special person that I want to introduce you guys to. But first, if you are listening or just found me for the first time and you found me through Spotify, make sure you hit the follow button and also the little bell so that you can get notifications on the latest episode. If you are listening from an Apple podcast or any other podcast platform, make sure you also hit their follow button and also the notifications button. So let's dive right in. I have a very special person that I want to share with you guys. But first, I want to talk a little bit about who she is first, and then I'll tell you what she means and how she's connected to me. I have Dr. Laverne Dowling on the interview with us today. Dr. Laverne Dowling is a clinical psychologist and the owner of Focus Behavior Health Group. She and her team, they provide enriching and mindful solutions for people in the areas of relationships, career, and life changes. Some of the areas that Dr. Dowling focuses on is anxiety, depression, trauma, adjustment disorders, child adolescent, coping skills. She also works with the military and veterans issues, PTSD, safe and sound protocol, and clinical supervision. They have several approaches, which we'll go over them today, with the intent to help others grow, heal, and move forward to where they want to be in life. I want you guys to welcome Dr. Dowling and my best friend, Laverne.
Thank you so much for that wonderful intro. I am smiling from ear to ear.
I'm so glad that we got to do this today. And I was telling folks, this is going to be a wonderful conversation. I have known Laverne, Dr. Dowling, since we were, teenagers,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So
yes.
We've known each other for over 30 years. Yeah. And so I'm glad that I was able to get her to come and we can have a wonderful conversation about therapy, psychology, and how important it is for our lives.
Yes. I'm so glad to be here.
Yes. So I'm going to call you Dr. Dowling.
Okay.
So I know you for many years, yeah. But those who are listening to us might, don't know your story. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of want to dive right in and ask, I guess the first question is, mm-hmm. Why psychology?
Okay. Well, I think the reason why I serve those folks who obviously are needing and seeking some change in their life. And I think just from an early age, even in, adolescence, I certainly think of myself as having a servant's heart. And with that, I have always been inclined to lean towards folks who had something they wanted to say, share, express, and it didn't always have to be a happy story. I was, one of those people in this world who kind of I have a comfort level with being able to stay present with individuals who have really experienced something that is, not something that a lot of people fortunately have to experience, such as when bad things happen. I'm certainly able to, I believe I am, able to just sit with that with them and connect around being able to move through those difficult spaces and just come out of that even better, right? Thriving, mm-hmm. instead of having to be in a space of survival. So being a psychologist, I didn't start out that way, actually. My trajectory was a little bit, it meandered. It was kind of like a river. So I started actually in social work. I did that for several years as a licensed clinical social worker, worked in childcare, and then actually in serving in that role, I had a lot of young people who needed and required to get a psychological evaluation. And as a social worker, I just got really intrigued. I was really interested in, you know, what was on paper did not match the person, the little person that I was looking at. I saw so many strengths and abilities and talents that just could not translate into the diagnostic picture the way that I had experienced them in real time. So I said, well, how do I learn how to do that? Because I saw that with children of color, particularly, that wasn't happening from the psychologist's report. And again, the child that I was working with as a social worker, those two things didn't match. So I did my research and I found out, okay, in order to do those assessments and that diagnostic work and eventually treatment, the world of psychology was the way I needed to go as far as a doctoral level education. So I did that and I learned, and here I am today, you know, being still serving with my servant's heart to the best of my ability.
Wow. You just said something that was so impactful just now. And I think a lot of listeners might resonate with and might even get what Oprah would say, their aha moment. You said what you saw on paper in terms of those children, like what the abilities didn't match. And so obviously you saw something was blocking that, the ability for others to also see that.
Yes.
Would you say, yeah.
Yes.
Which is what's happening a lot in the world. People tend to look at young adults and, you know, create a specific label or call them something else, when in reality they have a lot of gifts and talents and beautiful things to offer the world if they just had the opportunity to get what's in the way of them becoming that that individual. Yes. Thank you for that. Thank you for listening to the call. Thank you for listening to that call, which kind of was what I was going to ask, if there was ever a story that kind of prompted you to get to that. That was it. How many years have you been in practice?
So as a psychologist, I've been in practice for 11. And it's been wonderful. I really, you know, yes. And even on my own paper that, you know, so-called defines me as a psychologist, I really do integrate so much more than what I was trained and taught initially. So I've been in practice for 11 years, and I've had my private practice, Focused Behavioral Health Group, now for 4.
Got it. And Focused Behavioral Health is based out of Chesapeake, Virginia, right?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, it is.
Now, I know that you have, from your offerings, which we're going to go over a little bit, because I do have some questions that want folks to kind of understand a little bit what these approaches that you use. We won't talk about all of the approaches, but I chose a few that I thought would be interesting if people kind of got an idea of what it means. But before we get to those approaches, and I know that in the social work field, when you were a social worker and you saw all those things, I know that a lot of the, within the social work community, we'll go back in time a little bit. We tend to have a lot of children and people from urban areas. Mm-hmm. And of course, most of the urban areas tend to be a lot of African Americans. What would you say, and I think to this day, is the biggest apprehension when it comes to that community to seek a therapist or a psychologist?
I think it's twofold. I have come to experience through, you know, working with real life people who have been actually surprised when I walked through the door. They will kind of exhale and say, oh, thank goodness, you look like me. And so that's a part of a barrier, is that, you know, kind of the thought that as a social worker, obviously, if we're dealing with children and families, I mean, social workers don't just work with children and families. They do, you know, adoptions, they'll work in adult services, developmental services. And so, but one of the roles of a social worker is really to assess need and what those barriers to kind of thriving in one's life or in one's community. And so when I would be working with a family, for example, a barrier that I would see was trust, that time after time, those individuals and families, really trust was breached in a lot of different ways, with either, you know, making assumptions about a family or individual's capacity to really take care of themselves in the way that they choose. So one big barrier, again, was several systemic breaches of trust, where they would ask for help, the help wouldn't come. They would ask for help, they wouldn't be believed. They would ask for help, and it wouldn't, you know, be the right help at the right time. It would just kind of be forced upon them just because, you know, somebody else way up high said so, instead of truly listening and collaborating. So that's been one. The other prong where I found it to be a barrier in communities when, you know, trying to offer services is, you know, some might frown on this, but religion. That there are large sects of communities, religious communities, that believe, you know, therapy or mental health, in the sense of, you know, having a therapist or, you know, a psychologist to work with, is really frowned upon, even, you know, at some level discouraged, and that there are spiritual other ways through kind of traditional religious pathways to address a person's ailments. So that has been a barrier in my experience as well, that, you know, no, I'm not crazy, and I'm not, you know, I'm just going to pray it away. But certainly prayer is a part of healing, but it's not the only way to heal. And so that's been my experience, is where it was trust or religious principles have gotten in the way of folks getting what they might be actually needing and seeking.
Got it. Thank you. And I want to touch a little bit later on, I'm glad you brought that up because I want to talk just a little bit later about spirituality and psychology and how can they both help each other. But before we get to that, so that our listeners, as I think a lot of people sometimes get a little confused as to what a therapist, a psychologist, and a clinical psychologist and a psychiatrist, right? Because I know in back in the days, people, we didn't have, or maybe we did, I don't know, the different level, like therapist, psychologist, clinical psychologist, everybody just went straight to psychiatric help. And that's when people had, they were experiencing certain things that needed that level of help. Can you just kind of quickly let us know what the differences are between a therapist, a psychologist, clinical psychologist, and a psychiatrist?
Yes, yes. So mainly the levels are going to be based on sometimes educational level. So a master's level therapist, that actually can be someone who's a social worker, someone who has a master's in counseling, a master's in substance abuse and addictions. And so the master's level clinician, right, who does therapy, that's just the level of experience as far as education that they have. But they are, you know, very well suited for a lot of conditions. But when you're talking sometimes about the severity level or even approach to some extent, then you're going to go further into education and have a doctoral degree. When you have a doctoral degree in psychology, at least, and you're a clinician rather than a researcher, the clinician is able to do psychological assessments, unlike someone who is on the master level. So they'll be able to do just a lot more diagnostic work than would the former. Psychiatrists have a medical degree. So they're on the doctoral level as well, but theirs is medical. So what they're able to do with their medical degree is treat mental illness through pharmaceuticals, through prescribing pills. Now, a psychiatrist can also actually be a therapist, but the way that our society is moving as far as mental health, there are very few psychiatrists who do therapy as well. There's a few out there, but not too many. Most of them are going to treat the severer conditions with medication. And so that's pretty much the difference. Again, it's going to be a little bit on the skill level and different access to different tools, depending on the level of education.
Got it. Thank you for that. Because I honestly, I didn't know either.
Yeah, it gets a little complicated because
it gets a little complicated. Got it. With psychologists, I know a lot of people, and this is something that I, for the past few years, it's a term knowledge that we hear a lot of, but I don't know if people clearly understand what that means, especially for those who have never been to therapy or have gone to a psychologist or done therapy, is what they call talk therapy. And there's the word kind of flows around social media. But no one, what I noticed is no one really talks about what that is. They just describe it. They just mention it as if people know what that means. And I think that could be a little bit confusing for people that have never gone to see a therapist or psychologist. What is talk therapy?
Well, it's, talk is in it. So you definitely are going to be having an opportunity. So what the therapist is really wanting to set up is a space, an opportunity for, you know, someone to be able to express in words what is kind of their concern, what is their worry, is there an area of confusion in their life, or maybe they're at a crossroads and really need help kind of with which direction for them would be best suited for them. So traditionally you would sit down one-on-one. And now since we're in our virtual space, we're sitting down virtually, but you would, again, have that opportunity to express out, talk, and sometimes learn to express. So the therapist certainly can pick up very quickly in talk therapy, kind of the depth of your ability to express your emotions, even label them, and also to educate and teach you. So much of talk therapy, yes, is about listening, correct? The therapist is going to be listening very, you know, authentically, right? Really actively listening, not just hearing the words coming out of your mouth, but really kind of wanting to go beyond the words and hear about what happened or hear even your story. And so with that information that is shared, the therapist can really help folks sort out what has seemed very complex and then simplified enough so that the individual can learn skills, right? So skills are taught, and those skills might be thinking skills or assertiveness skills or skills around, of course, now we're doing a lot more body work. So learning about how your body and your mind are interconnected. And so it's just an opportunity for an individual to, yes, talk through, express through kind of life challenges. And then over time, hopefully it's not too long of time, that the person will be able to in that and go on and kind of live the life that they've wanted to live.
And what would you say, and I know therapy is not a in 6 months you eat well, or 5 months you're well, you know, what would you say would be a good time someone, of course, I know it's going to depend on what they're dealing with, right? Mm-hmm. But what would you say, it's like if they've done 6-8 years, is that like an average time that someone that is in therapy gets to a point where it's like, okay, this is enough, or it just depends on what they're showing?
Yeah, really good question. I have a lot of, I have a lot of clients who first start out in therapy, and that's kind of one of their questions to me is, how long should this take? And so it does vary on, I would actually say sometimes it's not the diagnosis itself, if we're just looking at that, but sometimes it's the willingness of the person to do, as you've probably heard many times in social media, to do the work, right? Mm-hmm. And so that really means that you've got to show up, you know, honestly, right?
Yeah.
Because the time it takes to sometimes, you know, get past the, you know, people wear masks a lot. And when I say masks, sometimes they don't even know they're wearing the mask. So the time sometimes that where it takes, you know, weeks or months to treat a condition is just because the mask has been worn for so long. So I would say, you know, if the person is truly ready to take a look at themselves, take a look at their relationships and circumstances in an honest way, then, you know, some therapies can, depending again on the intervention that's used, can really be 12 sessions, right? And so if you're meeting once a week, you know, that's just a few months. If it's, you know, there is brief therapy models that are very helpful, could be even less than that. But when you're on the other end of, you know, your therapeutic healing and processes, I don't think anything should be rushed, right? Because it's so important. Mm-hmm. And I'll use this analogy. So let's say, unfortunately, your body has cancer, right? You mm-hmm. want to make sure that it's diagnosed properly and that the treatment plan is the right fit for the problem. And if you are rushing through your cancer treatment, something could be missed, right? Mm. And so with therapy, with mental health therapy or behavioral health therapy, you want to make sure, particularly if your mind and body has been dealing with something so long, undiagnosed, right? Or untreated for so long, you don't want to rush through that. You want to honor the process. And so, you know, it does seem kind of like, oh, I'll be in therapy forever if my problem is so big. But mm-hmm. it's not something, again, that you just want to rush through because, for example, if you're taking medication, there's no skills in pills, right? You're not learning anything. You are just, you know, kind of masking in a different way or covering up or lessening your symptoms. So I think it's something to invest in, right? It's something to invest in yourself. So mm-hmm. I typically let people on average know, I can work with people, yes, very short term, brief, which could be about 12 sessions, or certainly 9 to 12 months, a year. There are a set of people that therapy is just a part of their wellness plan, mm-hmm. right? They go to the gym, they do yoga, they eat well, and they do therapy. It's just a part of their wellness program. So it's really a lifelong component of their wellness. So there's no kind of limitation on that.
And I'm glad that you said it's part of their wellness program. Mm-hmm. And just like anybody will come, you know, will go to the dentist mm-hmm. or to do their checkup, mm-hmm. you know, I really want people to start looking at therapy from that space mm-hmm. of it's part of your wellness program, mm-hmm. As opposed to something you go to because you're trying to fix mm-hmm. something, mm-hmm. right? It's just part of your normal life. Yeah. Thank you for that. I want to talk a little bit about some of your approaches, and how, and you know, what they benefit. I know myself, when I started doing therapy, it was just solely, well, my first experience with therapy. And I want to say this, and I want you to kind of chime in on it too. I'm glad that I actually remembered. Mm. You know, sometimes people say, oh, I went to a therapist, it didn't work out, right? Mm. And I want to say that by the time when I found my therapist, the person that I connected with well, I went through at least two or three different ones, if I can recall. Mm-hmm. And so I found the one that was like, oh, this is it was a good fit. Mm-hmm. Can you just kind of share a little bit about that too? Like a lot of people that will see a therapist for the first time, and it might not be a good connection, right? Mm-hmm. And what would you say to, like, how would you encourage someone to continue to seek? What's something to look for?
Good question. I run across that too, that kind of hesitancy or nervousness around, you know, is this going to be a good fit? And again, remember that trust piece that I had mentioned earlier about why there's could be barriers to getting a person, you know, through a therapeutic process. And sometimes it isn't a good fit. And you know, both parties have to be honest about that. So what I encourage people to do, think about it like, again, I'll throw another metaphor there for purpose of illustration, is you have a car and there's, you know, there's something wrong with the engine. You need your car to get from, you know, point A to point B. And so you take it to a mechanic. And if that first mechanic cannot fix it, do you just say, oh, well, I guess I don't have a car anymore? Well, no, you would take it to the next mechanic. And then you finally land on the mechanic that works and you get your car fixed, right? So with our mind and body, of course, we're not cars, we're not vehicles. But it's not that far removed to say, you know what, I really need my mind and body to work. And so it is worth me making sure that I match up what my needs are to what the person can provide and offer. And so sometimes that does take one or two times to really figure that out. We now have tools, fortunately, different sorts of platforms. I'll throw one out like Psychology Today, where you can filter your interests. You can filter your preferences to really hone in on, you know, a smaller pool. Gone are the days that we have to like go through, you know, the telephone book, right? We're not there anymore. So you really can learn a lot about a provider well before you introduce yourself. So you should do the work on the front end to say, you know what, I really need a person, what would make me feel more comfortable. So this is one of the series of questions I think is helpful to ask yourself. And, you know, when you are thinking about doing therapy, is to say, what's important to me? If maybe your therapist having a sense of humor is important to you, then, you know, seek that out. That's one of the descriptors that therapists will, you know, will put out there, that they have a sense of humor. They use humor to heal. Or perhaps you need a therapist for you in the season that you're in life. You need someone really that's going to be quite directive. They're going to say, hey, you know, really, you know, from a much more coaching or directive style of therapy, that they're not going to kind of be in that space of just exploring ideas. It's really going to be action. You're at that stage. You need some very clear action steps. And so you'd want to make sure that therapist has that type of therapeutic style. You know, and of course the logistic things that you'd want to make sure of. If it's virtual, does it have the option of being in person? The hours that you think are the best times to, you know, be able to connect with someone. So you really want to thoroughly think through and feel through what would be like a good match for you, similar to how you would pick, you know, a partner, a romantic partner, and say, yeah.
Yeah, I was gonna say, listen, like, right. You're gonna meet your person. Yeah. You might have to like go through a few.
Kiss a couple frogs till you get that, yeah, you know, that perfect.
We're not
life.
Kissing therapists out here, but hey. That is a perfect example of that. So it is kind of like, it's a relationship that you're gonna build in a
correct.
Way.
Correct, right? Yes, yes.
With that person who's going to be, you know, helping you move through those spaces in life.
Yes.
I know for me, when I started out, I didn't know what to look for. I just, you know, I put my finger, okay, this is the one. Mm. And I'll be honest, it was based on the name, or I didn't think about at the time if they were, you know, if they look like me. Mm. It was more like, okay, I guess this one sounds good. I'll go with that one.
Yeah.
Right. But of course, you know, as you begin to figure out what the things that you need, you're, like you said, you know, they look at what they're offering to see if it's a good match. It's kind of like being on a date.
Yeah.
I'm using that. Like, what do you like? What are the things that, you know, I think is a good start? I know that at some point in my own journey of therapy, as you know, I remember you were already, you were already a psychologist, I think. Mm-hmm. And I remember you telling me, which I want to go over a little bit also, you know, look for a therapist that focuses on CBT, which stands for cognitive behavioral therapy. Mm-hmm. I know that some people won't be able to, of course, diagnose themselves, right. But are there certain things they should look for in a therapist? For example, if they know they're suffering from anxiety, or, you know, should they look for therapists that deal with certain things that they're already feeling in terms of what's not okay with them?
It does help, I will say, to kind of narrow it down a bit. And there's certain conditions I would say, yes, you want to gear towards more of what I'll call as a specialty. Because not every therapist is going to know every model of therapy. I mean, maybe there's some unicorns out there, but most therapists, you know, they'll have a baseline. And with cognitive behavioral therapy, it's really, you know, it's designed to focus on, you know, if you're having, you know, kind of difficulties, again, in kind of thinking through things, and being able to, really understand how your mindset really can kind of set you on a course for either, you know, really effective, productive experiences, or not, or really kind of get you stuck and not be able to really kind of maneuver through, as well as with your emotions. So cognitive behavioral therapy is really good for folks who want to, you know, learn. And I will say, if you don't want to do outside, you know, therapy work, meaning outside of your appointments, and you just want to kind of talk and that be it for the week and see them next week, cognitive behavioral therapy really does focus on most of your work that's getting done. Your therapeutic change happens outside of the session. So they're going to be giving you, as they call it, homework, right? So if that's not something you're too busy to do all that, I would say, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy might not be your best fit, because they really are wanting you to learn something and then go practice it, right? So, but it really works very well on depressed moods or anxious presentations. It works very well. And it's actually, you know, the things that you will learn can last a lifetime. But if you're looking at more of something more specialized, then, and I'll put this in the category of trauma. So, you know, in the world of trauma, we've been, and when I say trauma, there's what we call big T traumas, which are your things like different childhood adversive events. So child abuse and all the forms that we're aware of. Or even adult abuses as well. And so when you're dealing with traumas, those big T ones, and even the little T's, which are kind of like, oh, I was in a fender bender and I'm really kind of scared to get back in my car and, you know, drive that same path. But even with those kind of smaller traumas, that you really want to make sure you are choosing a therapist who, at minimum, I'm going to use this phrasing, has a trauma-informed practice, right? Mm-hmm. So what that means is they understand how trauma can show up and persist in the body and mind. They really kind of have a sensitivity to that. And they're not going to miss kind of the impact that trauma can have on, you know, just normal everyday living that needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to go beyond that and you really want to work on some really difficult memories that are you're, you know, kind of trying to reconcile or physical presentations in your body, then you want to move towards the specialties in that area. And so that would be things like somatic therapies or eye movement desensitization reprocessing mm-hmm. therapy, which is EMDR. Mm-hmm. So, or there's cognitive processing therapy, CPT. So there's very, you know, and you don't necessarily have to know all of them, but the mm-hmm. the key to look at is, does this person work with trauma, right? And then they will help you decide of the menu of services, the menu of interventions, that would be a right fit, right? Mm-hmm. Because they don't all fit, you know, every trauma. But, you know, sometimes there's this opportunity to really carve out a unique course for you as an individual, right? So it doesn't have to be one-stop shop. You really can hone it in. But I would suggest that just to say, you know, start out with thinking, huh, how do I want my healing experience to look? Do I want to get a chance to just talk and be listened to? Do I want a chance to learn something? Do I want to have some real active change or all three of those? And so that really is going to kind of dictate what kind of experience that you can expect.
Got it. I'm glad you mentioned trauma. You brought up trauma because mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, when they think about trauma, is basically mostly in their minds. Mm-hmm. Like when I say mind, I say things that traumatic experience that they saw or mm-hmm. Or were part of, right? Mm-hmm. What they actually heard or, mm-hmm. you know, that caused a traumatic experience. Yes. And I know you mentioned EMDR. Yes. Can we talk a little bit about traumatic experiences that is stored in the body? Because I think a lot of people don't have the awareness that sometimes they might be okay in what their thought process, but the body still carries that trauma. Mm-hmm. And how the use of MDR mm-hmm. can help with that.
Yeah. So EMDR, it's been around
actually for longer than folks maybe realize, you know, 20, mm-hmm. 30 years. But it's now has become really kind of mainstream as far as interventions go for trauma-informed work. So what the...
And EMDR stands for, again, for...
Right. That's the hardest part is learning what it stands for. So it's eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. So I'll kind of break down that word a little bit. Mm-hmm. So the eye movement is not so much. So when it was first developed, eye movement was, and it's the eye movement typically from left to right, where you're tracking either the therapist's fingers, or if it's automated, then they'll have you track an object that is moving diagonally or elliptically or in any direction, but the purpose of it is that it's moving left to right and you're tracking it with your eyes. But since the coining of the treatment, we've gone past just eye movement. You can actually do the bilateral stim, and what that is our brain has a left and right side, so it's like kind of split down the middle by our corpus callosum. And the two halves of the brain we found serve different purposes, wonderfully so. And on primarily the left side of our brain is where our language is and where a lot of our kind of practical thinking and critical thinking goes as far as problem solving. And on the right side of our brain is more of our creative and innovative kind of adaptive side. But with trauma, sometimes those memories, and I will say, you're right to pick up on what I was sharing, is our memories are stored in those parts of the brain in different ways. Mm-hmm. So with our senses, right? So our eye, our vision, our hearing, tactile. So what we feel, as an example, and what we smell or even taste, get stored. Like, we're always recording. Our brains are always recording information, the good and the bad, right? And so when you've experienced a trauma, it gets recorded, not just in your brain through your senses, but it's in your body. Our brain and body are connected. And so, you know, what you feel on your foot gets stored in your brain as information, and vice versa. The brain remembers and it connects to that foot that, you know, experienced something. So from head to toe. And what EMDR does, so the desensitization, the bilateral piece, is about being able to activate the entire brain to be able for you to have access to it. And we do this in multiple ways, like I said, through sound or through a sight target or through a touch target, to be able to activate, again, both sides. So that's the bilateral part. Now, the desensitization part of the EMDR is about, as the word says, to desensitize. So the key is, when you go through something bad happening, you have the senses are picking it up, and your senses will remember it, meaning they'll translate them into maybe emotion, for example, or vividness as far as your recall. And it might be very distressing, right? Probably is. And the level of distress is getting in the way of your functioning. That's the theory. And so the desensitization part of EMDR is being able to calm down the mind and body from thinking it's happening right now because you're remembering it. Because the body is saying, oh, I sense it. I know it. I remember it as if it was right now. And then your body responds as if it is. So that's when people start to have heart palpitations. They get dry mouth. They start sweating. They become cognitively, they feel kind of dizzy and disorganized, is because the body is still remembering as if it is happening now. And it might have been something that happened when you were 5, but the body doesn't know the difference. And so the reprocessing part is where EMDR's real fun magic happens, and you're allowed to, in the now, the present, safely revisit those memories. And but now you're visiting, you know, them in the present, thinking back, kind of trailing back with the help of a therapist, of course, in therapy, in a safer way, right? In a very kind of I'll even use the word methodical, in a very kind of staged way that is at your pacing, where you are in full controls, and then you're able to place some what we call adaptive beliefs on there, where you're able to say, you know, instead of, you know, thinking something that is not helpful and at best is certainly not even accurate, right? Because it was like, well, this happened when I, you know, whatever the thing was when I was 5. Well, you may have at the time thought, you know, something negative like, you know, I'm not good enough, but for doing or being a certain way. But in actuality, the more accurate thing is to say, I'm fine as I am. I had the who I am was not the person that, you know, did anything wrong or deserved this. And so what EMDR does is helps you get to that more accurate belief. The belief that, you know, is far more adaptive and true than the one that might have over time kind of got sealed in. So EMDR is very profound, you know, work that can be done in really a short span of time. And it does integrate the body and making sure that we don't, you know, kind of just think it's in our mind, but our body has stored it. And we want to make sure that all of it kind of gets, as I call it, metabolized, right? So when you're really metabolized, if you just think about how we do with eating food and you break it down to the parts that are the stuff that are nutrient, the stuff that's going to, you know, help your body. Mm-hmm. And then you also discard the waste, the part that is mm-hmm. not serving you, that you no longer have to hold on to it. And so EMDR is really good at, as I call it, metabolizing trauma, right? Holding on to the parts that are good and letting go of the parts that aren't.
I think that's fascinating. And I'm glad you say the word metabolize, because as you were describing EMDR, mm-hmm. I was thinking like as if it was like you're putting something through your body and you're like, you know, kind of crushing it. Yeah. And I was like, and I was about to ask you, like, you mean like take stuff out and put some new thing in, like you're sweeping through something. So I'm glad you said the word metabolize, because actually it's a better descriptive of that than me thinking like we're sweeping something out and putting something in, was actually doing both at the same time. Okay, good. What a fascinating treatment.
Yeah, it is.
I'm like in awe of it. Like, how you describe it, I'm like, come on, MDR, do your thing.
Indeed. It's very, as a provider who does EMDR, it never ceases to amaze me as a true contribution to wellness.
I want to say emotional about it, because I know how much I store in my body. Mm-hmm. And to know that there's something out there that can actually go in and that we're going to process this thing to the point where we're going to keep what's good and just throw away and let the bad just kind of, you know, work through itself through the body. So here's, you know, and I want to say, you know, for those that are listening, you know, if you know that there's trauma stored in your body, if you have that awareness already or that knowledge, you want to make sure if, as you're looking for a psychologist, they have EMDR in their list. That could be very, very helpful for you. So that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Okay, I have one more approach that I want to for you to go over, one that I know we talked about a few times. Mm-hmm. And I think this one is going to be a really good one for you to understand what it is, because I don't think there's enough information about this particular approach. Mm-hmm. Out here, people are not really talking about it, which is IFS.
Okay,
Internal Family System. So can you tell us a little bit about what it is and how that does that work when you're working with a client?
So IFS is really another very good theory around, it's called Internal Family Systems. And so what it is focusing on is that us as individuals, right, we have parts of us. I mean, just to put it in a very simple way is, you know, sometimes we, you know, have parts of us that are, as we'll call them, like our protectors, right? The ones that, you know, if someone crosses our path kind of, you know, sideways, then a part of us really can be protective in the sense that it will be maybe our, I'll put a label on it, like the part of us that is really assertive, right? Or aggressive. And it really feels like it's really big, right? It kind of like the giant part of us. But then there might be another part, right? That is quiet and maybe holds all of our emotions. And so what IFS can certainly do is, one, help us differentiate, you know, us as a whole being, and maybe try to find the parts within us in and around our bodies, right? That, you know, we need to really start to pay attention to. Now, parts develop over time, right? And they serve lots of, you know, they have lots of jobs. Let me say that, right? Mm-hmm. So again, there might be a part of us, it's their job to make sure that they, the person has fun. Right? The part of you that's a venturesome and, you know, risk taker. But guess what? That part can't always run the show, right? Mm. So you want to make sure, like when you're thinking about your parts, that you pay attention to, you know, what's their job? Are they a fixer part, right? Are they the ones that, you know, are very vigilant and pay attention to a lot of details? And is that the right part to show up and kind of take charge? Now, there are also parts that, you know, unfortunately, we call them exiles. They're the parts that, you know what, we don't want them to really come out, but guess what? They hold, as we just talked about, the trauma typically. They're the ones that are most overwhelmed, the parts of us that hold the feelings and, you know, kind of are unfortunately banished away inside of us. Mm-hmm. And some people might even translate that from across theories as to be like our inner child, right? The one that, you know, just kind of remembers everything, but has not had a chance to, as we use, we'll pull from our last question, hasn't been able to metabolize anything. It's all unprocessed. It's the grief, it's the shame, it's the hopelessness. And so what kind of we want to bridge and be able to do is know that there's a part of us, the self, right? That's really the part of us that we want to hold everything together. But we sometimes lose sense of the full self. And I put that like a capital S self. Mm-hmm. And we end up having these separate parts of us, right? Our protectors or our exiles just take over. And we lose ourself in the process. And so IFS is very helpful to be able to have an individual become the whole person that they are, rather than having, and I'll use it from the platform, relationships with other people that seem like they have, they're one way with someone, and then with another person, they're another way, right? So let's say with their parent, they kind of feel almost younger than they're actually their age, right? You could be a full grown adult, but when you come in the presence of your parent as an adult child, that part of you kind of takes over. And you're like, gosh, I don't want it to do that. Because when you're with maybe your friends, right, this part of you that is very confident and self-assured is the one that's present. And you really want to be able to, wherever you go, with whomever you deal with, your full self be who's present and not kind of taken over or distracted by any part of you. And you really want to show up as a whole person. And sometimes our, you know, our lives have kind of created several parts of us, but we haven't been able to fully merge them so that we become oneself. And that's kind of what IFS is focusing on, is being able to, you know, kind of find those parts, understand them, but at the same time, be able to focus, turn on your attention pretty much on the inside and really flesh out, okay, what is, you know, what can we see and what are we experiencing and, you know, who's kind of showing up and we might need to do what? Pretty much educate our parts to say, you know what? We're not five anymore. Because that part was stuck back then. But we're now, you know, fully grown. And we can experience life a little bit differently when we're able to do that.
Again, another fascinating approach. It's funny, as you were talking about the parts that show up, like, you know, you're a full-blown adult, and then all of a sudden you go into a setting of where your family is, your parents, and you become 11 or, you know, whatever age you become. So it's two parts. One is an observation that I made, and then it's a question about that.
Okay.
So I was watching a show the other day, and where this young lady was, you know, having a moment with her fiance. And, you know, on the eyes of the world, you know, she was behaving like a little girl, right? Or what the world would call immature. Let's just call it that. But you can see they had, like, the person that was present at that moment was not a 30-year-old, rather, you know, someone much younger than they are because of the behavior. Yeah. Now, when she was with her friends, you know, so people were shocked to know that she had the type of behavior simply because when she was around them, she was strong and confident, and, you know, and to see her in a different way confused them, right? Mm. But the interesting thing is that she showed up that way in front of a fiance, which to me, the way I'm looking at it, as you were describing it, perhaps had a father figure in her world, in her life. I'm not saying that's what it is, but it just made me think about that. So is being in the presence. So I guess my question is, with that example and what you just described, women that have had issues in relationships, when I say I'm talking about cisgender women that has relationships with cisgender men, right? Would you say that in situations like that, like when people come, when they are dealing with a male figure and they haven't dealt with their father wounds, would you say that, so how would this IFS tackle that?
Yeah,
I guess that's my question.
No, I understand. You know, the basis, the tenets of the question, because it's so common that when you know you really sit back and pay attention, you can sense it that wow, I don't feel like myself, right? That kind of when I say self, I mean that self energy where you really are not feeling like part and parcel of who you are. And so it actually does show up in intimate relationships, right? And the reason why is, you know, using words, you know, that are very common now, triggers, right? There are things, there are circumstances, situations, you know, that bring out a certain part of us. And being able to say, to actually befriend the part, right? So, you know, with that example of the fiance who, you know, the circumstance was placing her in a distressed state, right? The situation, and she wouldn't have ordinarily handled it that way. Like I said, even people who were her friend didn't really even recognize her. What I would really want a person who presented like that with me is to say, let's get to know this part. Let's get curious, right? Mm. And really start to, instead of like, there's some therapists that say, let's get rid of it and, you know, make it go away. But no, let's do the opposite. Let's actually befriend it, right? Let's find out a little more. So once you kind of identify a little bit about understanding, you know, and exploring, you know, as I said, like find, focus, and flesh out, okay, let's pay attention to this part of us. And so it would really, the work would be behind, let's befriend it. And then, and there's certain, you know, there's, you know, several kind of key words to explore that, finding out more about that part. But then the next piece of it is, you know, what does this part fear? What was happening where that part said, I got to take over, you know, I'm not having this, like whatever the, you know, situation was. And so, you could ask the simple question, what does it want for you? Why is this part, you know, upset and really, what is it, what would it happen if, guess what, if it didn't have to do that anymore, right? So let's say the part wants you to feel love, right? Unconditional love. And it showed up because maybe the, you know, the fiance, the male part of this fiance, wasn't being attentive or was taking the person for granted or being disrespectful, right? It could just be, you know, something, you know, on a more serious tone. But that's who showed up, because that part is, its job in the moment is to protect, is to say, I'm going to have, I guess, right, it may look like a temper tantrum or something. I'm going to have this temper tantrum because I'm sick of it. And when I have temper tantrums, guess what happens? People start paying attention to me. And maybe that part of you
has learned that over time. If I get louder, if I cry a little harder, if I stomp my feet a little more, I get this type of attention. But really what it wants for you is maybe, you know, a healthy love attachment, but it doesn't know how to get it. And so when you're able to kind of slow things down and really kind of be thoughtful about, all right, what does this part want for me? What's it trying to do? Looking past the kind of, you know, the tears, looking past the upset feelings and saying, they don't want to harm you. They don't want to hurt you. They're out there fighting for you, but they just don't need that job anymore. Who really needs the job is self, the self energy. That's the part of you that is curious enough to find out what this part wants. It's calm enough and has enough clarity and connectedness and confidence and courage. And remember what I was mentioning about both sides of our brain, the creativity, the compassion.
Yeah.
That's the part. That's not a part, but that's the self-energy that we all, you know, are striving for so that our parts don't have to take over and kind of run the show in a way that's not really productive and makes us feel kind of not like ourselves, because that's not who's leading. So right. what that's really about is just being able to really slow things down, pay attention and say, okay, I'm ready to get to know all of me, right? And then be able to let those parts know, you know what, we're going to lead the show. And when we need you a little bit, we'll use you, but we might give you another job, right? Maybe that part of her, instead of trying to protect her from unconditional love, you can say, guess what? I'm going to make sure we're going to partner with someone who can provide that. I'm not going to put self in the position to be with someone maybe who is like harmful, right? Or who won't be able to provide that type of attachment. And so that's where the self can lead in a much more productive way.
I love that you said, let's find out what the part wants. instead of discarding that part of yourself, which I think a lot of us try to do, is discard a part of ourselves. Mm-hmm. We'll say, I hate this about myself. Mm-hmm. I hate this part of me. I hate, you know.
Yeah.
So, and then we can never become whole.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I love that approach of IFS, because to me, the way I'm looking at it is taking all these parts and just making you whole again.
Yeah.
And not discarding any part of yourself. And then I think that's the approach of, or the road or the journey in beginning of self-love can start.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, loving all parts of yourself.
Yeah.
With all these approaches, one of the things that I thought about, and I want to ask you, do you think, because I know a lot of people, when they go see a therapist, see a psychologist, and a lot of people are wanting this these days, which is, give me a pill so I can pop in and be all right, right?
Yeah.
Would you say that, and I'm not saying that medication is good or bad or right or wrong, but would you say that if these approaches are used, you know, are they sufficient so that no one can ever actually take medication?
In my practice, yes. Mm-hmm. In my practice, yes. I strive for that. But I, you know, also I'm not anti-medication by no means, but, you know, I'm going to start with someone's diet first. Like what are we putting in your body anyway? Are you drinking enough water? Right. What's your, you know, intake of salty foods? Cause you know, some of our body complaints are because of how we have treated our body, meaning what, you know, nutrients we put in it, what vitamins we have access to. I want to make sure you are feeding the very tool that we are trying to work with, which is your brain, which is your heart, which is your digestive system, right? Which is your nervous system. So I'm starting there. I don't want to put something on top of that, like a medication, when the bottom ingredients are not, you know, really going to heal from within. So that's why I start with, let's just talk about what we're eating, what you're drinking, and how much of it. But I will say, you know, once you, we could, a person starts to be very mindful of, you know, viewing their body as, you know, a temple or a tool or a vessel to be handled with care, then a lot of our wellness, again, it starts there. So, but yes, pharmaceuticals do, they are a tool. They do have a place, but I just don't think they're the place to start. So that's, you know, kind of how I have come to, you know, practice what I do is I want to just start with, because, you know, pills won't always be available. Sometimes people can't afford them. Right. And they have side effects that other means of healing our body don't. They just don't. And the other piece is access to them. There are folks, it's very hard to find a very good psychiatric provider. So some, it's sometimes it just systematically and like access to resources, it makes sense to do several other options well before you get to pharmaceuticals. So that's how I've approached it.
Got it. I love it. I really, really do. This is amazing information. What would you say, like, in just an average of people that you see on a daily basis? Any, you know, might not, I don't know if you might see this, but of course, we can look at the whole world, but at least within your space, that people are mostly dealing with right now in the world. Like an average, yeah. Like, I get 50% of people dealing with this, 20%, but what is the biggest average on what people are dealing with right now and why you think that is?
I think for me, what I, the lens that I'm looking through, I mean, I have a bit of a bias that I look through the trauma lens. And so I see a lot of unresolved traumas. But, you know, if I kind of pull back from that, I would actually say worries that, you know, and the cycle of worry is really interconnected with sadness. So if you worry too long, right, for an extended amount of time and a great deal amount of worry, it converts itself into sadness, that energy does. So I believe that because of, you know, the way that the messaging through society, through culture, is about watch out for that, be afraid of that. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's just the oh no culture, right? OMG culture. And so I have found that, you know, worries about one's health or worries about one's fertility or worries about one's, you know, being able to partner with some, you know, someone in life, worries about their own death, right? So the worries I have found have really kind of compounded because of this what if culture. Well, what if this happens and what if that happens? But again, if gone far, far long and in a chronic way, it really converts into a hopelessness and helplessness. And that really basically is where shutting down and depression resides. So for me, it's kind of like it starts in the world of the what if kind of OMG culture into just despair. So, you know, not to make the world bleak, because there's obviously, you know, a great deal of wonderfulness and out there too, which we try to balance those things. But, you know, I do see the folks that, you know, that I exchange with, there's a lot of worry that they lay down on the table in front of me. And, you know, it's cloaked with the plate of sadness. So we work with that.
Got it. I want to go back a little bit on, you had mentioned earlier, and I said I wanted to kind of touch on a little bit, because as you were talking about fear and the what ifs, right? And I know for me personally, I grew up in a place where fear was always present. You know, fear of, you know, catching a cold, mm-hmm. you know, put your coat on, or else you're going to catch a cold. This is going to happen, or that's going to happen, mm-hmm. you know. But one that was really like heavy for me is the whole spirituality thing, mm-hmm. you know. There is always, I guess, what in the U.S. people would say, God isn't like ugly, mm-hmm. right? There was always this thing about what God, like God mm-hmm. was presented in such a way, mm-hmm. you know. There was always this fear of this person that I've never seen, and this is what's going to happen if you don't do this. Mm-hmm. You know, all these what's going to happen kind of sort of thing. Mm-hmm. What is your take on spirituality and mental health? Like, mm-hmm. how can both work together to help someone heal?
Well, at this point, I almost don't think how it couldn't work together. So not just how does it, but it really can't be untangled at this point. I think if we're really talking about healing, truly healing, I will, you know, honestly, from my profession as a psychologist, that has not always been the case, that spirituality, faith, has been sidelined to a great degree. But, you know, kind of in recent years, it can't be ignored any longer. So the embeddedness and the integration of one's spirituality, I think, is paramount to being able to fully heal the whole person. We just talked about parts, right? And we're talking about mm-hmm. how, you know, trauma is stored. And if, you know, if it's stored in our bodies and our vessels, then we do sometimes need something, you know, outside of us, bigger than us, supernatural, to be able to help us along this road of recovery. So in my practice, I'm very, very open to really kind of listen and hear and help guide people to their spirituality, themselves as it be a part of them. I agree that there are sometimes the trauma is just that religion, that there are belief systems, and coming from a cognitive behavioral lens, you know, we do have to look at one's belief system and where it originated from, what maintains it, where has it kind of not been able to evolve and adapt because of experiences. And religion, right, exposure to, you know, certain religions or aspects or even certain versions, let's go with that, right? Certain translations of one's spirituality, maybe through, again, families of origin, cultures of origin. They really, you know, kind of maybe did a number on an individual, and that has, I'll use the word, that has been a sticking point, has made the person stuck in a certain way of believing that unfortunately has caused way more harm than may it have been meant for good, right? So you do have to kind of look at and go a little bit deeper to see how one's faith and spirituality can actually serve them in a healthy way, right? Rather than kind of bring down the person and maybe in a realm of shame or in the essence of feeling guilt-ridden about, you know, certain aspects of their choices or lifestyle. It really is, it needs to be a part of the conversation and a part of the work, for sure.
I had a quote that I wrote some time ago, and I put in one of my journals that says, you're not afraid of God. You're afraid of who you were told who God is.
Yes.
You know, because it's a very personal, I realize it's a very personal experience. Yes. And when I got that part, mm-hmm. right. How does one rebuild from that? Yeah. Like, because if you were told that God was a specific way, yes. right? Now we're dealing with the mental now.
Yes.
in the spiritual. Mm-hmm. How do you build from that? Like, how, yeah. what's the first thing that one should be doing? Okay, now that I know, mm-hmm. you know, this is the wrong idea that I learned about who God is, mm-hmm. then where do we, yeah. how do we establish something from that, yeah. from that space?
It's actually right in front of us all the time. It's relationship, right? And so when you are going to meet a stranger for the first time, you introduce yourself. Hi, I'm Laverne. What's your name? It's just as simple as that. Hi, God, I'm Laverne. I need to get to know you.
Yeah.
I want you to get to know who I mean, obviously God knows you, who you are in the belief I serve, but really it's the relationship. And yes, you know, a lot of young people across the world are introduced to their spirituality through other people, right? Through their relationship with that person. So think about that. That's kind of the filter, is if you sometimes look at the relationship you have with a person, it might kind of dictate the relationship you're having with the God they introduced you to. And so that could be a key right there where it's entangled, right? There's mm-hmm. there's a whole lot of associations with the human rather than the spirituality that need to be addressed. But when you are able to separate that a bit and have mm-hmm. the individual really kind of work on relationship building in with other humans, right? And mm-hmm. with themselves, then that really opens up an opportunity for them to have a relationship with Source mm-hmm. in a way that it doesn't have to be contaminated, right? Can really be strengthened just through connection. So, I would say to just kind of focus there on creating the relationship that is authentic between you and the Source, rather than having to be what others have told you, what others have placed rules on. Mm-hmm. I think that could be the building block to moving forward.
I think that's a great start. So I have one more question, and then I want to kind of I like to use the word complete mm-hmm. our conversation. Mm-hmm. But should one do therapy? Like, should therapy be something that's ongoing, mm-hmm. even when things are well? Uh-oh. And I say well on quotes. Because, you know, a person might not know if they might say, oh, I'm well, I'm doing good. But let's mm-hmm. say a person is doing well. Okay. Mm-hmm. Things are flowing. Things are good. Mm-hmm. Should therapy be ongoing even when things are going well?
Okay. I would love to be the person that says, absolutely. Because as I had mentioned earlier, wanting it to be a part of, you know, a full wellness plan would really be optimal. However, I do have to be practical to the listeners and say, you know, the way that our healthcare is set up, a lot of people pay, you know, for therapy through their insurance, you know, through their job and so forth. And so because of that, the insurance company is saying, hey, we're treating something. So the therapist is who, you know, is kind of looking for what is the something as far as, you know, something to intervene in so-called fix. So it really is unfortunate that our system is set up like that, but we're getting to that place of wellness and prevention. For example, in medical care, we now have, you know, prevention programs where you can get ahead of the problem and get, you know, support and services before there's an issue. But in behavioral health care, we're not fully there yet, where you can get therapy without there actually being an identified problem. We're not quite there yet. But what I would say is if you pay, you know,
without insurance out of your pocket, then, you know, of course there are going to be no limits to that as far as your ability to have those resources to cover that kind of care. But so that's kind of the only kind of barrier that I can see with that. But I would really encourage that, you know, if it is something that you, you know, can do to make sure that you're, again, if it's skills that you need, if it's, you know, certain insights that would be helpful, but again, there's not any particular identified, you know, problem or crisis, we should be on that end of it, where we're doing, you know, preventive wellness rather than, you know, waiting until things have gotten really bad. And yeah, so I would say yes to that. But like I said, I wanted to be honest about there are some barriers to that approach.
Got it. Thank you for that. So for those that are listening, having the self-awareness, what's going on, and just doing, using your tools, using your skill sets, if there is, like, insurance is a barrier in this sense. What is... Here's one, and here's one, my final question to you. What do you envision, you personally, for the future of mental health?
I think what I can see is more and more opportunities to learn integrating different healing work. In psychology, for example, and in just mental wellness. What I would love if we got to a place in our culture and society that not just in, like, you know, private and chartered school, like educational settings, but for our children, for our next generation, to integrate, you know, mental and physical wellness in schools, in just make it normalized, make it, you know, a part of deep breathing and mindfulness. And, you know, we're getting there a little bit where I see a couple things of, you know, yoga popping up here and there, but really, you know, saturating our culture and community and world with that aspect. I think we've gotten so distracted by just a lot of unnecessary things in life that we've forgotten the very power from within. We've forgotten how to therapeutically breathe. We've forgotten that a lot of our healing can happen, again, without any external things. And if we can really continue to share that, educate people. Again, I say, hey, let's start in the educational setting. Then I think the world of mental health will become clearly less stigmatizing. It will be very commonplace. That is my hope. And I do have more and more people who are quite willing to take the journey. Because they have heard, it's been on social media. It's being talked about in, you know, through politics, and yes, even in the church, we have, you know, pastors and, you know, clergy, in general, who are now much more open. We're not fully there yet, but I do see that vision. I do hope for it.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Darling.
Yeah.
My friend Laverne. Thank you so much for sharing what you shared with us today. I myself, you know, like all those things that you share, like some things that I've heard, but, you know, just how you broke it down, the education that you provided for us today was fantastic. And I will say this, it made me feel so much more easy, even though I've been doing therapy for years. it made me feel so much more at ease because it made me hopeful, not just for certain things for myself, but also for what's out here in the world. So thank you. Thank you so much. Where can people find you?
Yes. So I am scattered throughout the internet. Certainly just typing my name in, Dr. Laverne Dowling. We'll link you to my sites on a couple platforms, but Psychology Today is one that's a very easy way to find me and get in touch with my practice on that platform. Or just through our email address, which is focusbehavioralhealthgroup@gmail.com. Would love to hear from you. And if I'm not able to support, then I will certainly point you in a safe and effective direction. So thank you. Thank you for having me and having, you know, this conversation. I just think it's wonderful. And I'm so glad to share and be a part of this.
Well, thank you. And to our listeners, thank you so much for joining in, and I'll see you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Hey, you guys, don't forget to check out RafaelaSilva.com, where you're going to find healing tools, coaching sessions, and of course, resources to uncover your purpose and help you see what's possible. See you on the inside.